need for housing. And even another aspect of that is that although it's a misdemeanor, sex work charges, prostitution charges, 210, 212, 213, those are the criminal code charges, those go on your criminal record. So for individuals who choose to transition out of sex work, they have that criminal record that is following them, which prohibits them from entering mainstream employment, and again, as a means to secure adequate and affordable housing.
You mentioned the boundaries here in mm-hmm. Halifax. Can you explain that a little bit more for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Boundaries is something that it's basically like no-go zones for sex workers. It is not. It does happen in other parts of the country, but not to the effect that is happening in Halifax. Basically, what happens is that sex workers, when they are charged with the 213, which is communication for the purposes of prostitution or solicitation, they are taken down to the Halifax Regional Police Headquarters, and they're booked, and then they are, and then they have to sign off on release conditions. And what these release conditions are is basically a map. And there's two of them. There's the Halifax boundaries and Dartmouth boundaries, depending on where you get picked up. So let's say I was working in the north end of Halifax, then I would be given a map of predetermined zones where I cannot go. And these zones are significant. So they reach from, for those who are familiar with Halifax, from Yonge up to Roby, down to where the police station is, all of Gottesian Street, all of the north end pretty well of Halifax is a no-go zone. In Dartmouth, it's the majority of Dartmouth. So you're given this map and they're told, okay, you cannot go here, you cannot be in this area. Stepping Stone is in the boundaries. The North End Health Clinic, the Needle Exchange, the Methadone Clinic, lawyers' offices, doctor's offices, the probation offices, all of these essential services are located within boundaries where sex workers are told that they cannot be. We have sex workers and former sex workers, people who have transitioned out but are still on these boundaries, who live within places that they're told that they cannot go. So what is happening in Halifax as a result of that is that although the paperwork says, well, you can be out in the community to go to a medical appointment or to a legal appointment, that's not translating on the street. And there's a lot of factors that contribute to that, i.e. The poor relationship between sex workers and the police, for instance. So sex workers are being arrested and breached for going to the food bank, for waiting for a bus, for walking down to Stepping Stone. And we know that this is happening, and I know that this is happening because we actually witness it and go to the court for a court support program. And so what happens is breach, 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 breach. So on 1-213 charge that, say, I could have gotten about a year ago, we have some that I could have up to 40 breaches right now. And you get enough breaches, and then that is really significant. That adds up to prison time. And, yeah, and then you'll be before the court. So, again, and like I said, I know that, and when Pascal comes on later, she might want to touch on this, I know that that they have a similar thing in Montreal. But outside of Montreal and Halifax, I'm not aware of anywhere in North America that they are issuing boundaries like they are in Halifax. And aside from the criminalization of sex work, boundaries, the issue of boundaries in Halifax is one of the most significant obstacles and challenges to the health and safety of former and current sex workers in our municipality.
Wow. Hi, so I'm just going to jump in. It's Megan Gray from Atsom House in downtown Halifax. And certainly just one of the things that we see quite a bit is the issue with boundaries. Atsom House is also within the boundaries for sex workers. So even women who are homeless and who have those boundaries, it's certainly an issue even where they're staying. And as Renee was saying, it doesn't translate on the street in terms of going to just to appointments, what we end up seeing is women that we work with being harassed by police. If they're standing on the street even for just a moment, perhaps they're waiting to walk across the street or what have you, and really feeling harassed, and which does not help in what is already a most difficult relationship with the police in the city.
Yes, exactly.
So it sounds like the boundaries are also the area of the city where there would be the most low-income housing.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And also to where sex work, where sex work is happening. So what will happen is that, you know, if sex workers move, like let's say that they move to other parts of the city, the boundaries will just expand until basically you have individuals that are being, you know, again, banned from entire communities. And yeah, I mean, it's tragic that this kind of that these kind of human rights abuses are going on against one of the most marginalized populations in our society.
So the boundaries obviously affect sex workers' access to services. Does being homeless add any additional barriers for sex workers in accessing services?
Well, I think that, and we at Stepping Stone, we're doing a lot of work to work with community partners and to educate them on, you know, the unique needs of sex workers and services. I mean, research shows that, you know, sex workers will go to programs and services that, you know, that are tailored to them and to their needs. I mean, the thing with sex work, especially when we talk about street-based sex work, is that you're kind of dealing with the whole gamut. I mean, whether it's homelessness, whether it's poverty, whether it's issues of child custody, whether it's the criminal system, you know, we will at low income assistance rates in this province. You know, we will see it. But again, it's criminalization, and again, stigma as well. Even if, I mean, Stepping Stone, even we're part of the nationwide campaign to have sex work decriminalized in Canada. Even if, though, we were to decriminalize sex work, at the end of the day, we still have decades and decades of stigma and discrimination against sex workers because they are sex workers. So even when we look outside of the issue of the laws and the relationship with police and stuff, you know, there is still, you know, landlords who, for instance, you know, who will evict women because they find out that they're a sex worker, or that they do not want sex workers, you know, renting their units, etc. So it's also an issue of stigma as well when we talk about sex work and homelessness. But I do know that there are gains. Stepping Stone, we had a housing program, actually, just to kind of give you an idea of the depth of the issue around homelessness and sex work. And we're looking at starting this program up again. It was only due to funding cuts at the federal level that we weren't able to continue it. But through our housing program, where we placed sex workers and helped them to move into second stage housing, add some court, and then also like into apartments and stuff, we did 136 placements in one year. So, you know, we know that there is a definite need there, and that is, again, it's a significant issue when we talk about sex work, especially street-based sex work.
Just speaking to the issue of whether or not being homeless would add to those barriers, absolutely. If you're trying to access resources for any number of issues and your most basic needs aren't being met, then most definitely it makes it more difficult to access resources, services, different organizations or institutions that you might be trying to get into. If you are living homeless and you're not currently, if you don't currently have an address, you're not eligible for social assistance. That's a very simple one. So if you're couch surfing and trying to make ends meet that way, then you aren't eligible to even receive the very little funding that folks get here on income assistance. So I think what we see a lot of times at Some House, and certainly with a number of the women that we work with who are sex workers and others in other situations, there may be a number of challenges that they are dealing with that may have contributed to their experience that has brought them to where they are, such as trying to maybe overcome violence or experiences of addictions that they may recognize they need to sort of do some work on before they can really have a stable place to be, but not having that place to be is a barrier in itself to trying to work on those issues. So, you know, if your basic needs aren't being met at the beginning of the day, then it's hard to move much beyond that. And certainly organizations like Stepping Stone, who we would work with quite a bit, are working with folks who are currently on the street in shelters and things like that, and that those are the places that people can go to, but there certainly are lots of services where folks, when they're just trying to get by day to day, don't get to engage with.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more, and I know that we certainly see at Stepping Stone that, and Megan raised a really good point, especially on other issues like such as addiction and fleeing violent situations and stuff, where housing is one of the first, that's a key first step, right? I mean, you need to have that safe foundation. You need to have that housing set up, and then everything else. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, housing first. And I know that that's one of the first things that we always look at Stepping Stone, especially somebody, like Megan said, looking to overcome some significant obstacles or barriers that they've dealt with in their life.
Renee, you mentioned that even if sex work was decriminalized, there would still be so much social stigma that it almost wouldn't make, well, it would still make a difference, but not as big of a difference. Do you want to take the opportunity to maybe highlight some myths about sex work and clear them up?
Oh my gosh. there's quite a few of them, and even with street-based sex work as well. Some of the key ones that come to mind is all sex workers have been quote unquote pimped or trafficked, or that they were forced into the trade. That's not the case. Research, and even local research, I really have to recommend the book Sex Workers in the Maritimes, Talk Back by Gail McDonald and Leslie Jeffrey. And where that research in that book shows that even with street-based sex workers in Halifax, the primary motivation for them to enter the sex trade is economics, is financial, again, to overcome issues such as poverty and stuff. And again, these are just general myths. Like, the sex work community is a very unique community, so everybody has their own, obviously, different background and story. The big one, arresting sex workers prevents sex work from occurring in our community. Absolutely false. The reality is that, and we see this here in Halifax all the time, is that arresting sex workers actually pushes the industry further underground. I know a lot of folks say to me, well, what are you talking about? You have a street outreach program. Like, I'm walking around, like, I don't see any major strolls. It's not, you know, where sex workers are present. It's not like back in the Hollow Street days. But the fact of the matter is that we're out four nights a week, and we're actually adding more, looking at adding more stroll hours. And we can make contact with upward to 34 sex workers in a three-hour time period. So they're there, they're on the street, but due to arrests and due to crackdowns on police, they are in hidden, dangerous areas, and that's where they're working from. Another one is that focusing law enforcement, i.e. arresting the customers of the sex workers, will actually stop sex work from happening. And again, that's absolutely false. It's the reality is that it's not the number of customers, but it's actually economic trends and social conditions, such as unemployment, such as poverty, and the shortage of living wage opportunities that determines the number of sex workers that are out on the street at any given time. Another myth, I could go on. Sex workers were abused or assaulted as children. Not true, especially when we look at the unfortunate larger reality that actually one out of three women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. And like many individuals, some sex workers have been the victims of sexual assault during childhood, but there's also sex workers who have never been sexually assaulted as a child. And
I hate to cut you off, but...
Yeah, no, that's fine. Like I said, there's a lot of this.
Thank you so much for joining us. And if you don't mind staying on the line just a little bit longer in case anyone does pop in with a question that
sure.
you would be best equipped to answer, that would be great. And before we kind of shift gears, to talk a little bit about transition houses, Catherine Panteluk is here with us tonight to read some of her poetry. So hi, Catherine.
Hi there. Thank you, Jane. Just listening to Renee talk there, it's pretty amazing how we can be so judgmental. And the two poems that I'm going to read tonight are, the first one's called Protection, Love, Hope. And it's very easy to sit in judgment upon other people. We don't know what their lives have been like, so just listen with an open mind. You who sit in judgment upon me, dare not open your mouths in reality. Listen to my story first before you speak your mind of not knowing. Not knowing what I went through, what my life was really like. How I survived each day of pain and brutality. How my child survived too, the brutality of a man who hated himself for what he did to me. Who hated himself for what he did to himself. His life was not joyful. It was a painful existence of a repeat pattern for many generations. Pain passed from father to son to son to son. No one stopped it ever. No one. Why? Because they didn't know how to change this pattern of hate. This course of action that was abhorrent to all. Himself a victim of brutality. Himself a victim of lust for power. Of aching for love from all. Where were you then, you who sit in judgment now? Where were you when he needed protection, love, hope? Painless no more in his dark childhood. Marred by the brutality of another's childhood, cycles repeating themselves endlessly, unless we stop it, through caring and love, from one to all, from all to one, connected in our energy to one another, connected in our love to one another. Silently we speak of our pain, yet to release this demon that possesses mankind, it must be shouted from the mountaintop of life, ferried across the bridge of existence and time, sorted through the papers of destinies intertwined. Make sense? Of course you can deny. It is so much easier that way. Seek not to destroy yourselves or others, but to love and protect all through prayer and peaceful ways. Amen. Okay, the next piece I'm going to read. When you see people out anywhere on the street or anywhere and they need some helping hand, don't walk by. Just ask the question, do you need my help? This poem is called Feeding the Soul. Waken unto the morning with laughter and with light. The dawn is overcoming the darkness of the night. For all who sleep in slumberland, the dawn is clear to see. Not like the blind eyes of you who forget to see your neighbor, your friend, who turns their backs on the lonely child that stumbles in the darkness of poverty. For she is cold and hungry, and you have let her be that way, instead of giving so graciously to save her soul from dying of hopelessness. For it is not just her body that you feed with her gift, it is her soul, a soul needed so that she doesn't starve in loneliness and despair of hopelessness not wanted, but given without thought by you. The cold fills her bones, but the darkness fills her soul. Give the gift with a pure and loving heart. Cast off your shadows of not having, for you will see the real not having in her pinched face and frozen hands. Of mittenless hearts do we write. Be not afraid of losing your own stuff. Your society has created so much stuff and wanting that it is like a disease passed from one generation to the next. Loosen up your belted pocketbook. Loosen up the strings that tightly bind your hearts. Come from love and belief to a togetherness of sharing. Your world will be better for it, as will you, soul no longer shriveled with fear and blackness, nor frightened with listening to your politicians of not knowing. Your cup runneth over with the giving and the loving. It is the way to the true heart of love and saving one another. So be at peace with your empty bank accounts. They will not save you. Should you need love, only giving and loving and being will do this. Kiss each child with tenderness as if she was your own. Kiss her frozen tears to a melting into a piece of nothingness. Be at peace yourselves with the giving heart.
Okay, that was Catherine Panto. Thank you so much for those poems.
Thank you.
Now we're going to go into the second part of this hour on women and homelessness. This part of the show, we're speaking about violence against women. One or two women are murdered by a current or former partner each week in Canada. Violence against women is a daily reality in Canada that leads to emotional trauma, health problems, losing children, and increasingly, in our society, homelessness. And it's more a hidden homelessness, or some have called it housed homelessness. And we still have Megan Groh, the social worker at Atom House, an emergency shelter for women and youth here, and also Rhonda Frazier, who is the executive director of Chrysalis House in Kentville, Nova Scotia, and the media spokesperson for the Transition House Association of Nova Scotia. Are you there, Rhonda?
I am.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So most people are aware of visible homelessness. They can see it, see people on the streets or more on TV and the papers, but most women in particular face another kind of homelessness. What is relative or hidden homelessness, and how is it affecting women?
Relative or hidden homelessness, or I like to think of it as being at risk for homelessness as well. I think sometimes it's easier to wrap our minds around that. In terms of women who have experienced violence and abuse, in seeking safety, women often have to leave their homes, putting them in a very precarious position in terms of secure and stable housing. If dealing with poverty, then just looking at the lack of adequate affordable housing stock in most areas in this country will greatly increase not only her risk of being homeless, but also her ability to keep herself and her children safe.
With that, I think what you often see, too, is women who have left unsafe situations who may, whether they come to a shelter or are staying with friends, staying on couches, that kind of thing, often it's easier to return to the home where it is at least familiar and they have their things, even if there's abuse there, just given the fact that it is so hard to find housing that is affordable for folks to live in or a place that feels stable.
So what are the options? If between choosing to leave that house and where else would they go? Why would a woman choose a transition house?
Well, very often a transition house is chosen because of the level of safety that we can offer. There's a security piece to coming to transition house. The other reality for a lot of women is there's not a support network in place to give a lot of options. Not everyone has access to resources such as family, friends, money to exercise the option of going to stay with someone else before moving on to an apartment that you funded yourself, this sort of thing. So in addition to the safety piece, the ability to access programs, to access advocacy, to deal with things like custody or criminal court procedures, those sorts of things. There's also a real link to affordability.
Yeah, absolutely. If it's speaking about affordability, I mean, if you look at the majority of women that we're working with at the emergency shelter. The vast majority are on income assistance. Rental rates for single women are $300 a month if you're not on disability. And anyone who lives in Halifax or has ever rented an apartment in Halifax would know $300 is just, you can't rent a place for that amount of money. So it becomes very difficult to try and figure out what the next step is, which is why we need to also have more supportive housing options. There are some great ones in Halifax, but certainly we could use more, as well as, of course, more affordable housing that goes along with those income assistance rates. Because there isn't, when you look at a lot of affordable housing, the rates still tend to be higher than that $300. So they're still trying to figure out ways to make those two pieces come together, the gap there.
And in the rural areas, very often the lack of appropriate services, like for example, I think about second and third stage housing options for women who are leaving transition houses. Lots of rural areas in our province don't have those options, and options for supportive housing are extremely limited unless women want to leave the area that they're living in and travel to an urban area like Halifax.
Mm-hmm. And how does it look when the woman has a child or a couple children along with her?
Well, the issues, I think, become compounded then, because then you're also dealing, in addition to safety issues, in addition to how do I put a roof over my head and food in my children's mouths, then we're also dealing with custody and access issues. And the fact is, when women leave situations where there is violence, the risk to her safety increases when she leaves. So that's a reality that that women live with as well.
Okay, and how obvious do you think violence against women is to the general public? Where does public education come into this? As Rhonda, you're working at the Transition House Association of Nova Scotia. Do you work on any of that kind of thing?
We do as much work as we can towards education, prevention work, as we tend to call it. Unfortunately, and anyone who works in a nonprofit organization, I'm sure, can relate to this, because of such a lack of resources and such inadequate funding over a long period of time, we're more often caught in putting out the fire than we are at preventing the fire. Because when folks are presenting in crisis situations, of course, that has to be dealt with first. So prevention work that we do tends to be tacked on to the other work that has to be done out of necessity on a moment-by-moment basis.
And where would you like to see Nova Scotia head towards in this regarding homelessness and women?
Well, I think there needs to be a recognition of the many different faces of homelessness. What it looks like here in Nova Scotia may be different than somewhere else, but I think sometimes we need to stop studying it and talking about it, and we need to start doing something about it, which means increasing supportive housing options, as Megan said, or increasing access to services, increasing income assistance rates, those sorts of things.
Absolutely. It's interesting how many times you can have a conversation with the powers that be about what are the needs in the community, what are the current needs for those who are facing homelessness. The solution is actually fairly simple. It is, we need more affordable and supportive housing. And I think you're right on the button when you say we need to stop talking about it. We need to stop having position papers about it. We need to stop having meetings where we talk and then go back and think some more. It's putting the money and the power into doing those things. We know that that's what we need more of. We need higher income assistance rates as well, which would also help. But those pieces seem to be, you know, we say them over and over and over again, and yet there seems to be a lack of initiative in actually moving forward and actually doing the action.
And I think there needs to be a recognition as well for the complexity. People's lives are complex.
Absolutely.
People don't come forward looking for support saying, I'm a woman who has experienced violence and abuse, mm-hmm. and that's who I am and that's all I am.
Yeah.
Well, I'm way more than that. I'm a whole lot of things. and my strength and where I need support varies. And we need to recognize that and work with people where they are.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
Okay, and for the next portion, we have our guest, Gladys Reddick. She is the co-founder of the Walk for Justice in BC and an activist for the justice of murdered and missing women. And Mary Walton, the chair of Friends of Transition Houses of Nova Scotia, which advocates for the financial and general health of transition houses in Nova Scotia. Hello, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
Oh, great. I'm glad you made it. So, Mary, in the September 17, 2009 budget, the Nova Scotia government committed $500,000 to the 12 transition houses in the province. How has this benefited the women using those resources?
The Nova Scotia government set aside $500,000 for the 12 transition houses and 8 women's centers in Nova Scotia to be divided among all 20 of those houses and centers, essentially. So the amount of money each house or women's center was receiving is approximately $25,000, which is a drop in the bucket when you look at the deficits that most of these houses run to operate.
Okay, and Gladys, how is the BC government responding to women and homelessness?
Not very well, unfortunately. A lot of our programs, women's programs especially, and affordable housing is basically out of the question right now. As you know, they've got the big Olympic drive right now, and there's quite a few homeless people as a result of the Olympics being here in Vancouver. And unfortunately, women are on the bottom of that totem pole as well, so we're finding that a lot more women are out on the streets and very vulnerable to the predators. As far as housing goes, very difficult to find, very expensive. People don't realize that when they do want to come to Vancouver, they don't realize the cost of living is quite a bit higher for affordable housing as well. And we lost our federal funding for affordable housing, and we've got people out here who are working really hard to try and bring back that federal funding, because a lot of these vulnerable women, again, are falling prey to the predators on the streets, and as you know, BC has the highest rate for the most missing and murdered women, which is not a proud record, but the bottom line for most of the women going missing is not being able to have housing, not being able to feed their children. We've got the lowest rates, we've got the lowest work rates, we've got the lowest rates for also for social services, disability, and the cost of living is way higher than what our rates are.
I think that's one of the major similarities between both coasts, and I'm sure right across the board in between there's insufficient funding that is provided from our government. And, you know, we look at the United Nations report on women, and Canada comes in so low in comparison, 49th. Place in comparison to other countries in the world on our women's equality and how our government provides for the women. I mean, you take a look in the past few years, the cuts to the status of women offices, the cuts to the not-for-profit organization programs that are out there, the funding that they normally get from this federal government is been reallocated to other areas and no longer going to the women who are in need in our country, and that's something that is shockingly wrong, in my opinion.
How can we make women's rights visible and a priority?
I think
from
we need
West
to take...
Coast, I would say look, what we do is we walk for justice. We talk about the need for the UN declaration to be signed. We put out reports like the BC CEDAW report, report, which is the Canadian Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And we really rally for a lot of these places and healing centers and stuff that we need. And I'm not afraid anymore to speak to the governing bodies of this country and raise awareness with the public, raising awareness in my area, especially with the missing and murdered women's families. And the only thing we can do is keep on rallying to get the message across that we need these that we need this funding.
Gladys, can you explain what the Walk for Justice is and what you're up to this coming June?
The Walk for Justice is a grassroots organization that started in January 2008, and it's my co-founder Bernie Williams and myself have organized to pick up volunteer walkers, and we rely on donations to walk across the country, walk through the highways to raise awareness about the far too many missing and murdered women. We speak about all women. We speak about the mishandling of the cases through the RCMP. We speak about what the families feel about their cases being not investigated, and we're just bringing out the truth about what's really going on in Canada in regards to how many, the numbers of missing and murdered women, and how many people it affects. For every woman that goes down, there's 100 people that are affected by that, and you know, and it's happening in every community. There's no community that's not safe for women. And so that's what we do, is we raise awareness, and we are also we spearheaded the demand for public inquiry national, especially in regards to the First Nations communities, because the highest rate of missing and murdered women are in the First Nations community, even though we're only 4% of the population.
Great.
And this June, I'll backtrack a bit. First, our first walk was actually the Highway of Tears walk with my cousin Florence Nizelle, where we walked from Prince Rupert to Prince George, B.C., to a symposium that was held for the family members in Prince George for the Highway of Tears missing and murdered women. And then from that walk, I took that template, and I had a vision, and I contacted my good friend Bernie Williams, and we put the vision in action to walk for justice, and we walked from Vancouver to Ottawa in the summer of 2008, and we delivered to the Prime Minister a petition with over 2,500 signatures on it, and also a list of 2,932 names of missing and murdered women across the country. We also walked from Vancouver to Prince Rupert last summer, and that was to do the Highway of Tears walk from Vancouver. And then this summer, on June 21st, 2010, we will be leaving Kamloops, B.C. We'll be leaving, and we'll be walking through the Okanagan and down through to Soyuz, and then back up. And we're going to head across to Calgary, up to Edmonton, and we're going to complete the Highway 16, which is also dubbed the Highway of Tears. That highway actually runs from Prince Rupert to Winnipeg, so we'll be walking up from Edmonton to Winnipeg, and we will be hosted by the Canadian Human Rights Museum in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully heading up to the symposium that we're talking about up in Terrace, B.C. after that.
Okay, good luck with that. Well, maybe we'll have to meet you halfway.
That would be awesome.
you know,
one thing I can say about the walk is that when Bernie and I first started this action, we were kind of doubtful about the input, and we've realized that we've reached right across the nation, and more people are coming out every day and saying, yes, my sister's missing, my auntie's missing, and so on and so on. And we're going on into, you know, first it was a 10-year history, then it was 20-year history, and then we keep telling them, you know, this is a 500-year history, come on now. And, you know, the more awareness that we raise and say that we're not going to take this anymore, this is violence against women.
Absolutely.
And the thing is, you know, again, the government is responsible for taking away the housing. That's the bottom line. If you don't have a home, where else are you going to go? If you don't have a home, you're going to lose your children. You lose your children, you're not going to see them again until they're all grown up and they don't have any knowledge of their culture or anything anymore because they don't have care of their children. So this is, to us, this is kind of leading into another form of genocide. And the average Aboriginal woman has 5 children in their lives. If we're missing 3,000 women, well, then that's 15,000 children for the future generations.
And I think, Melissa and Gladys, that's one of the things that we all have to do is raise the awareness, like Gladys and her colleagues and brothers and sisters are doing with the Highway of Tears, is really getting out there and talking about it and no longer ignoring it or pretending it doesn't happen or hiding it. By doing so, look what they've started, and I know that we've heard about it and seen it and participated in smaller ways out here in Halifax. I know they had a walk around Lake Binook in Dartmouth last spring that one of my union activist colleagues helped to organize in her community, and it was all about the Sisters in Spirit and raising the awareness. So in order to make change, for the government to listen, for the public to know that this is a problem and we need to make sure that we have the funding to, you know, house the women and children in our communities, we need to be out there and be active and be activists and create the awareness. We need to not fear speaking to politicians. So many of us are intimidated by that. Go out, set an appointment with your MLA or your MP and lobby them and sit down and talk about what really matters to you in on these issues. And they'll listen to you. Now, the problem is that corporate companies have professional lobbyists who will go out and they go out on a daily basis and lobby the MPs and MLAs for their corporate needs, which limits the time that any activists who are comfortable talking to MPs and MLAs about the issues like homelessness and violence against women and the missing and murdered women who people choose not to see, and go out and talk to these people. And the more people who are willing to do that, it's not a hard task to do, the more they're going to listen and start taking it to task, because they'll be like, hey, my constituents are asking. It's not just these corporations that are asking for their own corporate needs. My constituents are asking about things that matter in our communities. So I encourage everyone out there listening to do that, to take those steps and make an appointment to meet with your MPs and MLAs to talk about the issues that matter to you. Because change isn't going to happen if we're not talking about it ourselves.
Yes, and I would like to add to that that we do as Walk for Justice. One of the things that we do is have a awesome contact list, and we do have a lot of corporate sponsors who have heard about these issues for the first time and are willing to support. And we also have many MPs who have been trying to bring it out for the last 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where we're stopped at is we're stopped at the top levels of government, where, you know, I'll be honest with you, Prime Minister didn't even come out when we invited him in September of 2008. He sent out a representative because he didn't want to come out and deal with the issue. And the thing is, this is where it counts, and we are getting louder, and we are getting more advocates, and you know, your MPs will listen. It doesn't matter what party they're in, they'll listen. If it's an issue in your community, talk about it. Don't let it fall to the wayside. If you've got an unsolved murder there that you're curious about, bring it up. Talk about it. you know, because you know what, those families of these missing women are, you know, they're at a loss here because there's been so much inaction happening right across the nation. It's really sad. And, you know, like, you can't blame just the police. You can't blame, you know, even the politicians. You can't blame them because there's something stopping them, and we have to find out what that is. But the one thing that is important is that, yes, we need to lobby for more healing centers. We need to lobby for women shelters for leaving violence. Where are they supposed to go if they're leaving a violent situation?
Thank you so much, Gladys. Thank you, Roy, for this really important conversation.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. But, you know, I would say, you know, we have to stop somewhere with this violence against women. We have to bring back our education programs for the kids and the women. And we have to rejuvenate the women's hope, because we weren't born just to you know, die on the streets like this. We weren't born for that.
Thanks,
we deserve
so
to be treated with respect from everybody. We're the life givers of society.
Thanks so much, Gladys. That's really true. That about wraps up our hour on women and homelessness. The second hour of the 14-hour live radio broadcast, the Homelessness Marathon, being played in 35 cities on community stations across the country, including CHUM in Whitehorse, CKLB in Yellowknife, EJFF in Burnaby, UFUU in Victoria, UFBX in Kamloops, CHLY in Nanaimo, CITR in Vancouver, BJMP in Powell River, CIUL in Abbotsford, CMUR in Prince George, CJLY in Melton, CKUF in Gabriel Island, CFRO in Vancouver, CKXU in Lethbridge, CJSW Calgary, CJFR Edmonton, CJTR Regina, CFCR Saskatoon, CKUW Winnipeg, CHUO Ottawa, CFMU Hamilton, CFRU Guelph, CJAM Windsor, CILU Thunder Bay, CFRC Kingston, CFBU St. Catharines, CHRY Toronto, CHRU London, CKUT Montreal, CHUQ Montreal, CKDU Dal, CILU Escassoni, CFXU Antigonish, CHMA Sackville, and CFMH St. John, CHMR St. John's. And up next, our next hour is on the state of affordable housing. That will be broadcast live here from Halifax. And then we'll have an hour on mental illness, followed by an hour on grassroots responses to poverty. Hour 6 will be health and poverty in Canada and the U.S. Hour 7 will be homelessness in the Olympic City. That will be broadcast from Vancouver. At 1 a.m., we'll have an open mic hour. And we'll be looking at poverty in Northwest Ontario, literacy and education. Literacy and education on the streets, First Nations, that we broadcast from Montreal. Policing poverty. Will also be broadcast from Montreal. Intervenance from Montreal, and HIV dans la rue, also from Montreal. So that will be the 14 hours of broadcasting that we will be hearing on 35 cities across the country. For 14 hours with hours broadcast live from Halifax, Montreal, Windsor, Thunder Bay, Vancouver, and the U.S. And that wraps up our hour on stay tuned for an hour on the state of affordable housing, which will also be broadcast live here in Halifax.